In Ukraine, protests have been simmering for almost 3 months. Now, fiery mayhem has erupted in Kiev and is spreading to other cities. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For this Politics Day, we look at developments outside and inside our borders. What's caused the latest flare-up in violence in Ukraine? Has that former Soviet republic become a battleground between East and West? And will a UN report accusing North Korea of crimes against humanity spur action from the international community? Here in the U.S., in about 2 weeks, the first of at least six Republican primaries will feature establishment Senate incumbents versus Tea Party challengers. We get started right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday here on the program with Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
In Ames, our studio there, Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Great to have you as well, Jim.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon to you.
Well, we heard it in the top of the hour, the flare-up of protests in Ukraine. Let's start off with that and followed up with a couple of other international developments. Protests have been simmering for almost 3 months in Ukraine. Now, fiery mayhem has erupted in Kiev. It's spreading to other cities, according to reports. At least 25 dead, we heard in the top of the hour news. Scores injured yesterday. A conflict that began in November when President Viktor Yanukovych rejected a trade deal with the European Union in favor of pursuing an economic deal with Russia. EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton released a statement in Vienna yesterday condemning the violence in Kiev.
I'm deeply worried by the escalation of violence in Kiev and the numbers of reported casualties. This violence and bloodshed must stop immediately. I'm also very concerned about the ultimatum to stop this by force. I call upon President Yanukovych, the government, together with the leaders of the opposition, to find an immediate way out of this deepening crisis and to continue the work to find a way to solve the political crisis through dialogue. As I've said on each of the visits I've made, the European Union stands ready to help in any way that we can.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton yesterday also adding that Ukraine should return to a parliamentary process and that government leaders should share responsibility for the crisis. Jim, do we know what caused the latest flare-up? There's blame going each way.
Well, I think this is just more and more of the same that we've seen, as you mentioned, since last November here. And, you know, the reluctance of Yanukovych to make any concessions to protesters. I mean, they have really rejected his latest bid, and he's sort of rejected any discussions with them. So I think that, you know, they're still at loggerheads for over the past 3 months, as you mentioned.
We heard in the news also all options open, a phrase used, sanctions, Secretary Kerry. I wonder, Jim, what sort of possible action could be taken in this climate, given that this is really, or is it, becoming a battlefield between Russia, the United States, and the European Union?
Yeah, the options for the U.S. are not very good. You know, much like we'll maybe talk about later about Syria, and we've talked in the past about Syria. I mean, first of all, if you look just at the geography, Ukraine and its long ties with Soviet Union and even with Russia here, make it difficult for the U.S. to have influence here. And certainly there's no stomach for any kind of action of a military variety. The United States has provided about $100 million in aid for the last several years to sort of civil society groups in Ukraine to try to build up, you know, the proponents of democracy. So cutting off that aid seems really would be entirely dysfunctional. I think so we're really left to, as one diplomat once told me, we'll just have to talk this thing through. He wasn't talking about Ukraine, but he was talking about the Middle East. And this is a problem that may be as intractable as in the Middle East here. So jawboning is what we have. I think what is encouraging from even your newscast is that the U.S. and the EU seem to be on the same page. I'm a little bit skeptical that even if you put sanctions on, individual leaders, how persuasive that will be for them to make concessions here. In one sense, you have to be concerned that sometimes putting on sanctions will actually drive the leadership in the direction of, in this case, in the direction of Moscow here. So there are not a lot of good options. I think the best we can do is get a unified position, continue to have a drumbeat of opposition to the kind of violence that is there, and hope there is enough international community support that would dissuade either the Ukrainian leadership or the Russians from taking any more decisive military action here.
Dennis Goldford, I wonder if you can tie this into the U.S. Russian relation and the tensions that have existed there now throughout the Obama administration.
Well, it's certainly not helping the relations. But, Ukraine for the Russians and Vladimir Putin is not their backyard. It's their front yard. geographically and logistically, there's absolutely, well, maybe that's too strong, but simply nothing that the U.S. can do other than, as Jim said, to talk about it a lot. They're from what I understand, there are rifts or divisions within Ukraine. In the West, they lean more and identify more with Europe, European culture, the EU. The East, there are more Russian speakers. They lean more toward and identify more with Russia. Russia, as I said, with Ukraine in their front yard, wants to keep them part of what I think they used to call their near abroad, since they were part of the Soviet Union. This would be analogous to the Russians trying to interpose themselves between the U.S. and Canada.
Mm-hmm. Were this to be the Cold War era? We're in a different era, though, now, right? And we don't really have the Russia that is the Soviet Union as a global power, do we?
Well, no, but we have on the part of President Putin, one of the reasons why they wanted the Olympics, why they've gone to such great lengths to do this. Putin wants to reestablish Russia as a major actor on the international field. It's one of the reasons why, referring to what Jim brought up earlier, they got involved in Syria. They don't want to be dismissed as just this has-been power with China, perhaps the main alternative power to the U.S. They want to be players on the world stage. And so this becomes very important to them. And there's still rivalries between the U.S. and Russia, even if Russia is not the Soviet Union.
Putin also famously made that statement that the greatest disaster of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind in terms of the kind of mindset that Putin and the Russian leadership has at this particular juncture. And, of course, Ukraine, and I'll mention Georgia because there was obviously another incident or a war, actually, in 2008 over Georgia. So I think these are really very, very much test cases. Russia has been really adamant about, both Ukraine and Georgia, at least at one juncture, they've now sort of backed away from that, have sought membership in NATO. Which was sort of complete the NATO package here of Eastern European countries as well as Western European countries, and Russia has been able to thwart that kind of effort.
Okay, we're talking international politics at the moment. We'll get to the domestic side of politics on this Politics Day with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. And if you have something of concern that you'd like to throw out as far as a question or a comment, please join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. This a sidebar issue, but the Olympics are going on right now. Two members, and we've been hearing a lot about this in the media. That's why I'm asking. Two members of the Russian feminist band, a protest band, Pussy Riot, were detained in Sochi Tuesday. This was near Olympic Park and the Olympic arenas. They were walking down the street when the police came and arrested them, accusing them of stealing from a hotel room. A pair released after a couple of hours, wearing brightly colored balaclavas and singing. One walked out with a raised fist. Here's a little audio from that.
we heard you were beaten inside. Somebody was beaten. Is that true? What happened?
Inside, yes, we were beaten because we didn't want to tell anything without our lawyer.
Women have continued to speak out against Russian President Vladimir Putin. One of the band members said on Twitter that they were in Sochi to work on a new song called Putin Will Teach You to Love Your Motherland. Jim, a lot of attention in the West given to this band, this protest band. Does it put any pressure on Putin at all? Does he care?
I don't think so. I think that he...
So it's just for us.
I think it's for external, edification rather than anything else. I can't imagine that it has very much impact on the leadership, although it does suggest, if I can use this term, the kind of thuggery that continues to go on within Russia here, and that certainly fuels in the West and Western states, the kind of image that we have, I think, of Russia even after the demise of the Soviet Union here.
Let's go to Jack in Davenport. He wants to weigh in on this issue. 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Jack. What's on your mind as you listen?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I listened to your program. I listened to the characterization of your guests describing the events in the Ukraine. I have to say that I disagree highly with them. Putin is a dictator. He is sending his troops in. He denies it. But if Yanukovych was left on his own, with no Russian support, he would have been gone long ago. Mm-hmm. And the divide between the East and the West, there are politicians in the East, the so-called Russian-speaking, they don't want Putin either. So I'm afraid that your guests are characterizing, and this cannot be compared to the U.S. and Canada. We do not send troops to kill Canadians, what Putin is doing to Russia. So that's my point. Thank you.
Jack in Davenport, thank you. Jim, would you like to respond to Jack?
Well, I'd be interested to know about what kind of data he has in terms of Russian troops. I think that if there were, in fact, Russian troops, I think that would be much more made of in some of the reports that we have. There's no doubt that, Ukrainian security forces, and I suspect that they get training and support from the Russians here. And there is some speculation that maybe after the Olympics, Russia would be more assertive, if you will, with regard to Ukraine here. But I hope that's not the case, but we can certainly see if that occurs.
Let's move on to another issue in international politics that's developed this week. On Monday, UN investigators releasing a report finding that North Korean officials committed widespread crimes against humanity, including torture, infanticide, summary execution, starvation, enslavement. Here's Michael Kirby. He's chair of the UN panel that calls for the justice for the country's leaders' actions.
At the end of the Second World War, so many people said, if only we had known, if only we had known the wrongs that were done in the countries of the hostile forces, if only we had known that. Well, now the international community does know. The international community will know. There will be no excusing a failure of action because we didn't know. We do know.
Okay, in an unusual move, the UN panel also gave notice to North Korea's supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, that he could be held responsible for these crimes. Jim, does having no excuse for an inaction mean there will be some sort of action against North Korea? What could be done that hasn't already been done?
Well, there's been three UN resolutions over the nuclear policy against North Korea. I mean, I suppose that is the one kind of action that could be taken. What Kirby also said that he sent this letter, as you mentioned, to the North Korean leader, and there's been no response from North Korea. He shared this report with China, and they have sort of dismissed it as they do not want to get involved in these kind of internal affairs. So it makes it more difficult to get kind of action. And given the really volatile situation in Northeast Asia at the moment, any kind of more vigorous action, maybe some more sanctions, maybe pulling back from any kind of food, but that's sort of dysfunctional for the U.S. and its allies, for the North Korean people or non-governmental groups. Again, it's frustrating because it's what kind of action can you do against this hermit kingdom that refuses to be at all responsive to the international community?
And is nuclear armed.
And is nuclear armed. Very good. Yeah, add to that. That makes it even more difficult. Sorry.
Dennis, go ahead.
No, Jim, when you mention hermit kingdom, that's precisely it. When you have a country that's relatively isolated to begin with, there's not a lot more you can do to them. You know, if the leader, glorious leader, decides to travel outside of North Korea, which may or may not be the case, you know, there's the Spanish law allowing their judiciary or their police to arrest anybody suspected of some sorts of crimes of humanity against humanity, but they're cutting back on that particular law. There's not a lot you can do unless you threaten them that his best friend Dennis Rodman can't come visit anymore.
Are there any domestic political considerations, depending on whether the U.S. does something or not in North Korea? Does President Obama have to have any domestic policy considerations?
Well, the major domestic concern, other than wanting to say here's a particularly nasty person and nasty regime, is, as Jim mentioned, the nuclear weapons. And potentially President Obama's opponents could tie U.S. Inaction on that, although that goes back to President George W. Bush, to the administration's difficulties in dealing with the probability or at least the possibility of Iranian nuclear weapons. So they could raise some generalized attack, not that they haven't done it before, but increase that on President Obama's foreign policy as being particularly feckless.
I think that's really the point. Dennis has really hit on it. These series of events that are going around the world, and the United States seems to be incapable of taking any effective action. Now, I'm not arguing that there are a lot of options, because the options have really narrowed in terms of both the American public would support and what we could actually do realistically. But I think there is a kind of a reputational problem with these kind of series, that whether it's Syria, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's North Korea, the inability to sort of produce any kind of more favorable outcome, I think, does have a lingering effect and obviously fuels opposition at home.
With so many hot spots in the world, Jim, you mentioned Syria. Give us an update. What's going on there? We don't exactly see it in our headlines much anymore.
Well, I think the biggest thing is the explosion of these refugees. I mean, just a report yesterday, I think it was, of there are 900,000 refugees now in Turkey and living in really squalid conditions. But the other big development has been these barrel bombs that apparently this just sounds incredibly inhumane. And I want to come back to the sort of responsibility to protect doctrine that should be invoked both with North Korea and Syria here by the international community. But these barrel bombs that apparently the Assad forces are using against opposition locales is just unfathomable.
Well, can you describe what they are?
Well, I'm not sure I can, but apparently they dropped them out of helicopters, and they have all kinds of shrapnel and nails and everything inside of them, and they explode upon contact, and apparently are sufficiently powerful enough that they can destroy buildings and destroy populations relatively quickly, or at least maim a considerable number of people.
They're designed to inflict as much pain and damage and injury as possible.
This is similar to a cluster bomb.
Well, in effect. You want to hurt people and do it in a nasty way and send a message in doing it, however barbaric.
It's called terrorism, actually.
State terrorism.
That's right.
Keeping in the Middle East, let's go to Iran. Today in Vienna, six world powers and Iran on a second day of talks to map out a broad agenda for reaching an ambitious final settlement to this standoff over Tehran's nuclear program. The six powers, the U.S., Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany involved. Jim, where is this right now? Is this moving along? Is there going to be any agreement reached?
I'm pessimistic about this. I think what we're going to hope for is there'll be a six-month extension, which the original agreement called for. I think that's more likely. There was at least one report leaked that the Iranian foreign ministry thinks that there will not be an agreement. I think, You know, if we think, if past is prologue, the Iranians have, in previous negotiations, dragged these things out as long as possible, if I might use that expression here. And I think that's what we're likely to see in this instance as well. So my hope is that we can extend the interim agreement and continue to verify that the Iranians are living up to their commitments of not, you know, enriching uranium, and that they have actually pulled back to the 5% under the agreement.
If there's no broader agreement, Dennis, does this hurt, well, Secretary Kerry and also President Obama politically in any way?
Well, you know, there is a certain feeling in the country of just being tired of all the U.S. involvement in these terrible situations around the world where we can't seem to accomplish much. That feeds somewhat of the more libertarian notion of foreign policy associated with the Pauls. But you know, on the other hand, there's this classical neoconservative view that there's no world problem that can't be improved by the application of U.S. military power. And a lot of people, although not neoconservatives, argue against that as well. So you've got a situation in which, once again, we seem to be at the point with Iran, at least, that the only possible way of moving them off the dime is a meaningful threat of military force. And the president seems apparently not willing to do that. We don't know what the Israelis might do. And that's where the president's getting a lot of criticism, that the only way you can accomplish something with people who are dedicated to a particular goal is a credible threat of force. And we're not there yet, if at all.
You know, public opinion polls keep asking this question they have over time, whether the United States should mind its own business in the world. From my point of view, and I guess I would be in opposition to that, but there's been an increase that the United States should really mind its own business and sort of stay out of the world. I don't think it's at the point of isolationism, because you ask the question if the United States should also be involved in the world, and you get sort of contradictory opinion. But there clearly is limitations on what the American public will tolerate and what the United States will do.
If we look back at the beginning of this century and look back over the 20th century, isn't that a real pendulum that is very obvious from isolationism toward isolationism and back towards interventionism?
There really is, and I think, you know, Dennis hit it on the point. You know, there's this kind of frustration among the public of how much we can really accomplish and how much we have accomplished. And, you know, the residue of Iraq and the continuing war of Afghanistan obviously sours any kind of action that is beyond maybe economic sanctions or diplomatic jawboning.
Okay, we want to pick up our discussion after we take a short break. When we come back, we want to talk about some comments that Secretary of State John Kerry made when he stopped in Indonesia, picking up on climate change. Also related to that, we want to talk about fuel standards, the president taking action on those without Congress. We'll get comments on that. Also, the minimum wage, the debate over that, and also a new report released by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which can be cherry-picked by either side to support their respective cases. Also, GOP primaries coming up in 2 weeks, the first of at least six Republican primaries. We'll talk about what effect that may have on the GOP's bid to retake the Senate. It's Politics Wednesday with Jim McCormick and Dennis Goldford. We hope you'll join our discussion. 1-866-780-9100. Back with more of Politics Wednesday after a short break. Great to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This winter, you may remember a couple of stories gaining national attention regarding brain-dead pregnant women and their unborn children. One husband kept his wife on life support until that baby was born. Another husband fought to take his wife off of life support. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at these cases from the eyes of medical professionals and the families who have been through similar situations, families here in Iowa. Ethical questions in the emergency room are our topic for the hour tomorrow on this program. Politics Wednesday today. sweeping around the globe, actually, to hot spots, talk about developments, and now sweeping around to the home front with Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University, along with Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University. Gentlemen, let's talk about climate change, if we can, because as part of a diplomatic tour of Asia this week, Secretary of State John Kerry stopped in Jakarta in Indonesia to encourage international collaboration in the fight against global warming. Kerry stressed that because of climate change, Indonesia is one of the most vulnerable countries on Earth.
When I think about the array of global climate, of global threats, think about this. Terrorism, epidemics, poverty, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, all challenges that know no borders. The reality is that climate change ranks right up there with every single one of them. And it is a challenge that I address in nearly every single country that I visit as Secretary of State, because President Obama and I believe it is urgent that we do so. And the reason is simple. The science of climate change is leaping out at us like a scene from a 3D movie. It's warning us, it's compelling us to act. And let there be no doubt in anybody's mind that the science is absolutely certain.
John Kerry speaking in Jakarta, Indonesia. He stressed that 97% of scientists agree that climate change is unequivocal and that those people who deny the facts are simply burying their heads in the sand. Dennis Goldford, if 97% of scientists agree that climate change is unequivocal and caused by what we humans are doing on this planet, why in this country does it continue to be such a source of controversy in national politics?
Well, there's a symbolic dimension to science and claims like this. And I was thinking, listening to Kerry, there's a parallel with the debate we don't want to enter into here, evolution versus the idea of intelligent design and creation. And remember, President Bush used to say, well, teach the controversy. And people in biology would say, there is no controversy, certainly not within science. And that's the claim that Kerry's making here, that there is no controversy within science. And for a long time, of course, we would defer to the idea that science is this wholly rational, dispassionate, non-ideological kind of enterprise. But at the same time, it seems to be a field, or people see it as a field, in which you have experts attempting to tell the rest of us what's right and what's wrong. And there's a certain populist element of that that Americans don't like, especially in recent years. But with regard to climate change, it's the symbolic dimension, I think, has come from the fact that to the people who oppose it, they're not looking at the particular scientific claims themselves, although there are always going to be issues, even if not major controversies. But to them, people who support this idea of climate change are people with not a scientific agenda, but a political and cultural agenda. The people who oppose the idea of global warming and climate change believe that the people who advocate that have the agenda of delegitimating, undermining advanced industrial capitalism. And so for them, this has taken on that tremendous political dimension, and the scientific aspect of it becomes really secondary to this broader political and cultural opposition.
Jim McCormick, I wonder if you can tell us if other countries have a similar political debate when it comes to climate change. Is the science so far afield from the politics in certain cases, or do they match better in some countries?
Well, I think the European Union is really as one that they obviously endorse the idea that climate change is a reality and that the science is pretty strong on that. Other countries, you know, take a country like China, for example. I'm not sure that they would dispute that there's, climate change, but you know, they want to point their finger at somebody else as being responsible for it. So I think that is sort of the, going back to what Dennis said, the kind of the political dimension that some states and some leadership in other states might take on. But I think in the European setting and the developed world, or even our neighbors to the north in terms of Canada, although they have now sort of backed away from the Kyoto Protocol, they certainly would embrace the idea, and they would look askance at the Americans who say that really would challenge the science on this in this particular area.
Remember and help me. And of course, his name just pops out of my mind. It was a Paul Ehrlich. Back in the 70s, the beginning of the environmental movement. I mean, he was making claims that by a date that's – and we're well past that date now – we'd be not just out of resources, but we'd be in just terrible circumstances with regard to climate and starvation and things like that. And none of that came true so
right.
far.
There's the Club of Rome report.
The population bomb, yeah.
The Club of Rome report also about the same time, you know, talked about, you know, used the analogy of a lily pond filling up, and suddenly we would be overwhelmed by whether in this case pollution and other kinds of lack of resources and so on. There's an interesting article actually in Foreign Affairs magazine that I actually use in my class that raises that again. And he, of course, this particular author raises the whole question that these, as you said, Dennis, these predictions have not come true. And this gives, you know, credence to the idea that maybe some of this is just really over the top in terms mm-hmm. of the kind of predictions that are being made.
On a related note, this week at a Safeway distribution center in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, I guess it was yesterday, President Obama outlining successes in sales and innovation by the auto industry spurred by increased fuel efficiency standards for cars, also for light trucks. He went on to explain why he is setting new targets for fuel efficiency for large trucks like those used by Safeway to haul freight across the country.
Heavy-duty trucks account for just 4% of all the vehicles on the highway. I know when you're driving sometimes it feels like it's more, but they're only 4% of all the vehicles. But they're responsible for about 20% of carbon pollution in the transportation sector. So trucks like these are responsible for about 20% of our on-road fuel consumption. And because they haul about 70% of all domestic freight, 70% of the stuff we use, everything from flat-screen TVs to diapers to produce to you name it. Every mile that we gain in fuel efficiency is worth thousands of dollars of savings every year.
President Obama also cited this as an example of what he promised in his State of the Union address, a year of action. Action taken using executive order and not legislation to accomplish one of his goals. Dennis Goldford, this fits into the environmental concerns, the strategy that the president has of not including Congress when Congress won't go along with him, right?
That's right. Now, of course, I believe there's a claim that the original Environmental Protection Act enables him, acting through the EPA and other such agencies, to do these sorts of things. But particularly when he threw down the gauntlet to Congress saying there's certain things I can do by executive order, I don't need to come to you, you can be sure that particularly the Republican-controlled House will be looking very carefully at the kinds of actions he proposes to undertake and perhaps will raise challenges to his authority to do them.
After 5 years of the Obama administration, how effectively, Dennis, has this president dealt with climate change?
Well, the people who are skeptical of it would say he's gone too far. The people, particularly in the Democratic Party, who are very concerned about that would say that he's not gone far enough. We still have the Keystone Pipeline issue lying out there. He's not made, to my knowledge, a determinative decision on that, even though a recent report suggested that it would not cause huge problems. At the same time, people point to examples of oil spills and broken from either railways or broken pipelines and things like that. So, you know, no matter what he does, he's going to irritate the people who thinks he's gone so too far and irritate the people who thinks he hasn't gone too far enough.
Jim McCormick, thoughts on this?
Yes. Cap and trade was one of the things that President Obama or candidate Obama talked about, and certainly in his first year in office, tried to get that through, got it through the House, but it stalled in the Senate, and cap and trade as a legislative matter has become sort of a dead letter. He has had some success, it seems to me, in moving, the fuel standards for cars, improving those by 2025, getting up to over 50 miles per gallon and so on. The latest effort is in terms of utilities, coal-fired utilities, and imposing standards on those to move. And we'll see this move towards natural gas facilities for generating electricity. So I think you can point to a few things, but certainly the idea of the climate change president. And he went to Copenhagen and got at least on paper an agreement with India and China and so on of helping countries in terms of their environmental problems. Those monies have not been generated, really. They talked about creating $100 billion fund, and that simply has not come to fruition. So it's a very mixed record. I think on the whole, the president has done more on some of these global common issues than the previous administration, like climate change and like the nuclear proliferation issue.
Surveying recent political developments with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's look at this in our area of domestic politics this week. A report released Tuesday by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the CBO. It was titled The Effects of a Minimum Wage Increase on Employment and Family Income. Political fodder here, gentlemen, for both sides of the debate over raising the minimum wage in steps. I guess that's the proposal to $10.10 an hour by 2016. True, the CBO report says it would push employers to cut jobs. About 500,000 of them, says the CBO. True, also, though, the proposal would raise, would lift nearly a million Americans out of poverty and put billions into the wallets of workers who are eager to spend, according to the CBO. What do they say? 16.5 million low-wage workers would get bigger paychecks, perhaps stimulating some slack consumer demand. Dennis Goldford, how do you see this issue? Also fitting in, isn't it, that with the president's second term agenda focusing on income inequality?
Well, he's a little ambiguous in that regard. When you talk about income inequality by itself, Americans tend to be okay with that. That is, Americans certainly believe in equality of opportunity. Americans tend not to believe in equality of result. And when the president talked about, for example, he went back to Osawatomie, Kansas, and echoed a kind of Teddy Rooseveltian theme in this regard, 100 years ago, there was a concern about growing concentration of wealth and income and economic power. And the concern was the impact of that on our democracy and especially on equality of opportunity. So if the president is talking really about equality of opportunity, he's talking about something all Americans can relate to, all Americans favor. The question is whether the actual increasing inequality of wealth and income has a negative impact on equality of opportunity. But if he's talking simply about equality of opportunity, then that cuts against basically American political culture. He's trying, I think, to raise a general theme so he's not considered to be doing simply what's called small ball in the remainder of his term in office. You know, second terms are often disappointments, no matter whether they're Republican or Democratic or conservative or liberal. And, just talking about a series of executive orders is not something you make a second term out of. But I think he's articulating a theme that, to some extent, Democrats could try to run on in both 2014 and 2016.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up here with talking about the GOP primaries. We wanted to get to those 2 weeks from today, the first of at least six Republican primaries featuring establishment Senate incumbents versus Tea Party challengers will take place in Texas. I think John Cornyn against some GOP challengers in Texas on March 4th. Dennis, is this the same storyline we've been seeing in the last couple of elections, 2010, 2012? And can we expect the same outcome in 2014 when there's this infighting within the GOP. They want their best candidates to be put forward after the primaries, and there's arguments to be made that that didn't happen in past elections.
Right. Well, we have to remember that in primaries and caucuses, too, for that matter, the people that show up to participate or to vote are not representative of the party broadly, let alone the American public. On the Democratic side, they're much more liberal than even your average Democrat. On the Republican side, they're even more conservative than your average Republican, let alone the rest of the country. And since we're talking about the Republican primaries and challenges here, particularly these harder-line conservatives believe the reason they've lost elections in 2008 and 2012, as I think I've said before on the show, is that the party and the candidates weren't conservative enough. So they're pushing them even further. There is this sense in which they see a political party less as a coalition than as a church of true believers. You've got to have these right, these correct views. That gave us Sharon Angle and Todd Akin and Murdoch in Indiana and O'Donnell in Delaware. They should have had winning candidates to control the Senate by now, the Republicans. There is pushback against this on the part of various Republican groups to try to make sure you have the most conservative electable candidate. But for the folks who participate in the primaries, many of the more ideologically conservative ones, for them, simply being hardline conservative is electable. They don't see a contradiction there.
I wonder, Dennis, and you too, Jim, weigh in on this. To what extent will the GOP's chances of taking back the Senate be decided in these primaries, which are to start in a couple of weeks?
To a great extent, they're in pretty red states anyway. So it's not going to hurt them tremendously. And structurally, Democrats have a big disadvantage. I think they have to defend, what is it, Jim, 6 or 7 seats, Senate seats held by Democrats now, but in seats that went to Romney and disliked the president in 2012. Democrats are defending overall something like 23 seats.
That's
and the
right.
Republicans
yeah.
something like 11. So structurally, this favors Republicans.
But I do think the primary results in these states, if one of these named senators gets knocked off or sort of the mainline favorite of the Republicans get knocked off, I think that really gives the Democrats an advantage. I mean, structurally, Dennis is absolutely right. It looks like that Republicans could pick up 6 seats, which they need to take control of the Senate. But I'm reminded of an article I read a long, long time ago in studying political science called, it was entitled, Divisive Primaries Hurt. And what the results of that analysis was that, you know, if you have a divisive primary, it really makes it difficult to win general elections because some people stay at home and you don't have the kind of turnout and you have these kind of surprise results. I mean, Indiana comes to mind of, you know, in the 2012 cycle where a divisive primary really, really had an impact.
And it also provides ammo for the general election, does it not? So we have not only John Cornyn, we have Mitch McConnell facing
sure.
a primary, Lindsey Graham, Pat Roberts, and our neighbor to in Kansas, Lamar Alexander, and so it pretty much does your oppo. What do they call that in campaign speak?
Opposition research.
Your opposition research is just done. You just take it from the in part.
It depends upon the state, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Kentucky is very, very red state, but Allison Grimes, I think, is an attractive candidate for the Democrats. And people talk about Wendy Davis in Texas, but, you know, Texas has not elected a Democrat to a statewide office since 1994. If Steve Stockman, who's a bit of an oddball, were actually to beat John Cornyn, it still makes it very difficult for me to think that Texas
right.
would vote for Wendy Davis.
Let me wind up here. We have a minute or so left. Let me bookend this. We started international. Let's leave international because there's an interesting new poll out. For the first time since 2001, more Americans think the war in Afghanistan was a mistake than believe it was a good idea. The first time this has happened, according to a new Gallup poll, 49% said the war was a mistake, 48% not. Compare this to the first poll taken on this question in 2001. Fewer than 10% thought that decision to go to war after the attacks on 9/11 was a mistake. So, Jim, your reflections on how political opinion has changed about the war
I think a couple points here. War fatigue is what I'd point to first of all. You know, this turns out to be America's longest war, and so I think war fatigue set in. And I also think another way to explain it is sort of memory loss, because you know that Afghanistan was right after 9/11, and there was a great rally effect. And you know, we do know that what happens in public opinion polling is there's a decay effect, and it's sometimes pretty rapid. And it's taken a bit longer with Afghanistan, but that decay effect has occurred.
Given that two administrations, Democrats, Republicans, beginning the war, and a Democratic administration in office now, will there be blame, Dennis, you think, for Afghanistan?
Well, somebody might try to use that, obviously, for partisan purposes. You know, we spent a lot of time with who lost China and then a lot of time with who lost Vietnam. But I think quickly, I know that if you think back to Vietnam, you know, the reason we got out was not, despite the fact they'd like to think so, the anti-war movement. It was the American people had the view, win it or get out. We're not a patient people. And I think that's where we are with Afghanistan.
Dennis Goldford, Jim McCormick, thank you so much for this hour of analysis. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University. Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Thank you for taking the time, gentlemen, to come into our studio.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had help in Ames from Garrett Van Leeuwen today, and also help from John Pemble. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.